Why did the post-flood generation build the Tower of Babel? Did they really think that God lived in the clouds and they built a building tall enough they could reach him? Or is there something deeper going on? And who is Nimrod? And why is it that I believe he might be the most important historical figure that you've heard the least about? We'll talk about these topics on this week's episode of the Faith by Reason podcast. Welcome to the podcast. The website behind it all, as always, is faithbyreason.net. Please check it out. Tons of great information there. Please subscribe to Faith by Reason. Just go into the right navigation bar, type in your email, and you will get alerts for every time we publish a podcast or a blog. And you can also obviously listen to the podcast on iTunes and Google Play and TuneIn Radio and some other sources right below the player that you're listening to right now. So please do that. So in the last podcast, we finished up our series on the second dispensation, and we are now ready to start talking about the third dispensation. And remember that the dispensations are God's contrastive way of showing that proving that his plan for humanity is the only one that is right and just, the only one that will work. And he does that by dealing with man differently during different periods of time. That's what I mean when I say dispensation. Just consider them different eras of time where God deals with man differently. And in each one of those eras, he gives man the opportunity to choose righteousness and justice. Obviously, God, who is right and just, he gives him the opportunity to choose God on his own and thereby qualify for the meaning of life, which is to be with God and be like God on his own. And he gives man every reasonable opportunity to choose God on his own before God rightly and justly implements his plan. So in the very first dispensation, the situation was man was completely innocent without knowledge of good and evil. And the question was, would man without knowledge choose God? And the answer, of course, was no. Original sin happened, the forbidden fruit, and man fell. In the second dispensation, which we just wrapped up, the opposite situation occurred where instead of having no knowledge, God gave man many, many years of life in order to amass knowledge. Man lived an average of 700 years. And the question was, if man had a lot of time and no sense of urgency and could just amass all the knowledge he could, would he use that knowledge to choose God? And the answer again was no. Man, instead of choosing God with his knowledge, man began to rely only on his accumulated knowledge to provide the answers to life. And so that, in addition to the angelic incursion and the Nephilim, which we talked about a couple of podcasts ago and a little bit in the last podcast, I'm not going to go any further into that. But because of that, God flooded the earth and only saved Noah, who was probably the only pure human left. And again, that has to do with the whole Nephilim incursion that you can listen to a couple of podcasts ago and get that. And flooded the whole earth and just saved Noah and his family. So now we get to the third dispensation. So as a result of the second dispensation, man's life was curtailed. Instead of living hundreds of years, he would now max out at 120 years. So that would obviously give a much greater sense of urgency since he didn't live as long. And it would also put him in a position to be in a community. Before this third dispensation, man was pretty much an individual and just, again, relied on himself and his long life. But now man would have urgency and community. So the question in the third dispensation is, if man has a sense of urgency and purpose and community, they're all gathered together with one purpose and a sense of urgency, would they use all of that industriousness to choose God over himself? Of course, the answer is no. Spoiler alert, they failed that dispensation as well. But we're going to talk about the hows and whys and look into a few myths that we hold about Babel that aren't true, or at the very least are a lot deeper than we give them credit for. You see, as I've said in previous podcasts, a lot of the very familiar stories that we hear about in church and in Sunday school, we kind of take them for granted because we think we know them so well that we don't really look at just some simple facts that if we just examine them a little bit would give us new insight and just let us know we can't rely on our traditions and our favorite stories. We have to really look at the Bible and take it seriously. I'll give you an example. Let's look at what immediately happened after the flood. So, you know, Noah's three sons, their wives were all on the ark, and the ark landed on the mountains of Ararat. Notice there that it's the mountains of Ararat, not Mount Ararat. Traditionally, the orthodoxy of the Christian church, the biblical church, states that the ark landed in Mount Ararat in Turkey. But that cannot be possible. That cannot be where the Noah's Ark landed, because we learn in Genesis chapter 11 in the second verse that the people who, the population at that time, journeyed from the east, meaning they were journeying west, to the land of Shinar, which was in modern-day Iraq. You cannot journey from Turkey going east and end up in Iraq. You just can't do it. So Mount Ararat cannot be where, in Turkey, it has to be the mountains of Ararat, which has to be a different place. Most scholars who study this have come to the conclusion that the mountains of Ararat were probably in northern Persia or modern-day Iran. Because from there you can go, obviously you can go west and get to the plains of Shinar, to Mesopotamia, current-day Iraq. Kind of trivial, but the point is that, again, you have to look at what the Bible says, not what your traditions say. And that's what Faith by Reason is all about. It's about challenging you and challenging your current beliefs and your religious traditions so that you understand the truth. And I'm doing that because, as I said in the last podcast, I want to help you grow. And you only grow by being challenged. And you are challenged when these orthodox beliefs you have, these traditions that make you comfortable, are disrupted. So again, that's what I'm here to do. So trivial, but it's just another example of what I want to do. I want to challenge you and help you grow. So Noah and his family, they exit the ark. They start reproducing. I'm going to skip the whole incident with Noah being uncovered or naked in his tent and being uncovered and Ham seeing him and telling his brothers and the curse on Canaan, because I cover this in the a podcast called Naked and Ashamed, which is part of the First Dispensation series. I go in detail about how what happened was not just Noah being naked and his son seeing him. It was actually the first homosexual act documented in the Bible, where Noah's grandson Canaan homosexually molested him. Again, go back to that podcast. I'll put it into the show notes and you can read about that. So I'm not going to go there. But let's just move on to Genesis chapter 10, which is the so-called Table of Nations. This is a documentation of where all the descendants of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's three sons, where who they are and sort of kind of where they go. Because all these people, all of his descendants, basically populate the rest of the earth, and they are the forerunners of a lot of the nations and nationalities and ethnic groups to a degree that we know today. But here's the thing. The Table of Nations is fine. It's nice for academic study, but it cannot be used to designate races based on a lot of the doctrines and philosophy of people who believe in racial superiority, basically racists. And if you remember from the podcast on Darwinian philosophy, I believe very strongly that racism is stupid, it's ignorant, it's a ridiculous theory. Just because you came out of your mother's womb with a certain skin color or hair texture does not make you better or worse than anyone else. It's absolutely idiotic to believe that. It's the height of comparative thinking, which is pride, which is what God hates. But there, it is a good question to ask. Where do the different races come from? Where do people who are dark skin versus light skin in the extreme come from? And to answer that question, you really have to, first of all, look at how God sees race. And that's actually kind of a misnomer, because God doesn't see race the way we do. He does not differentiate people by how they physically look. That's a very human thing. We are very comparative thinkers generally, and we look at the outside. God does not look at the outside. He looks at the inside. He looks at the heart. He doesn't care what you look like or what your skin color or hair texture or the size of your nose is. He cares about what's in your heart. And even from the genetic level, there's only one race, the human race. Every man or woman who exists is a descendant of Adam and Eve. We all have the same basic genotype. And when you were in school, and if you took a biology course in high school or college, you probably heard about genotype versus phenotype. Genotype is, again, your genetics, the deoxyribonucleic acid that makes up your individual genes. And the phenotype is a physical expression of those genes. So genetically, we are all of the same family. We are all humans, Homo sapiens, if you will. And any differences in our phenotype, our physical characteristics, and any value that we put on it is totally man-made. Unfortunately, that does not just exist with the secularists who are Darwinians, which is kind of interesting because folks who are hardcore, I guess you can call them progressives, who are always claiming to fight for minority rights and things like that, they also happen to be Darwinists, and Darwinian philosophy is extremely racist because it states that the races are evolved, quote unquote, differently, and only the fit races should survive and the unfit races should be wiped out. So I don't know how they justify that contradiction. Well, they probably just don't think about it. But it's not just, unfortunately, it's not just a part of the secular mindset. It's also in the religious / Christian mindset. There have been many so-called Christians who are racists. Like the Ku Klux Klan, for example, they are an organization that's obviously racist, but they also claim to be Christian. And they try to use the Bible to justify their racism, and you can't do it. But they try to use the Table of Nations and saying that Noah's three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, are the progenitors of the three root races, Japheth being the father of white or Caucasian people, Ham being the father of black or African dark-skinned people, and Shem being the forefather of Middle Eastern Hebrew Jewish people. Well, and because of the curses that Noah put on Ham and the blessing he put on Shem and Japheth, it should justify racism because they say that, again, since Japheth was the father of Caucasians and Noah blessed him and God recognizes that, so God says that the white people are the blessed people, and I guess the Middle Eastern people are too, even though the Ku Klux Klan seem to hate Arab people as well, but whatever. They were blessed, and since Ham, the father of the black people, was cursed, then it totally justifies mistreating and enslaving and oppressing and colonizing black people and African people and any dark-skinned people. Well, that's stupid for many reasons. The first of which is that, number one, Noah didn't curse Ham. If you read the Bible, Noah cursed Canaan, Ham's son, and Canaan's descendants did not migrate into Africa. Yes, Ham's descendants went to Africa. Canaan was not one of them. Canaan actually went east. Was east of Africa. He's actually in the land that we call Israel now. That's where the Canaanites went. In fact, the entire book of Joshua is about the Hebrews expelling the Canaanites from the promised land, from Israel. So you can't use that to justify mistreating dark-skinned African people because there's no such thing as a Hamitic curse, which is what the racists call it. Canaan was cursed, not Ham. Another reason it's silly is because, as we will talk about in a few minutes, for a couple of generations at least, all of the descendants of Noah were gathered in one place, and they all intermarried with each other. There's no reason to believe that at Babel, Japhethite men only married Japhethite women. They probably married Hamitic women and Shemitic women, and the descendants of the men of Shem also married Hamitic women and Japhethite women, and the same with vice versa with all of them. So they intermarried. So you can't try to get any kind of purity of race from that because they all mixed together while they were in Babel and under one language. Another reason is that although you can trace the migrations of some of these groups by their heritage, be it Shem, Ham, or Japheth, and because on the male side, they kept the family name, so even if a Japhethite man married a Hamite woman, she would become a Japhethite because the male carried the family name. And yes, they did, a lot of them did go to Europe, but some of them also went to India. So Japheth is not only the father of fair-skinned, fair-haired Caucasians, he's also the father of darker-skinned Indian people from the subcontinent of India. And another reason that this is all silly is because it leaves out several pretty populous races. If you just have Ham being the father of African black people and Shem being the father of Middle Eastern and Japheth being the father of Caucasians, where did Asians come from? Where did Native Americans come from? Where do Indonesians come from? Well, they came from, again, all these, they came from descendants of all three because, again, there were no purely racial lines. And yes, Ham is the father of black Africans, but he's also the father of North Africans. Sub-Saharan Africans were descended from his son Cush, but then you have his other sons Put and Mizraim, who went to North Africa, and North Africans look different than Sub-Saharan Africans. And also, one of the descendants of Canaan, who was a son of Ham, was called the Sinites. The Sinites traveled east, and they became the people we currently call Chinese. In fact, you can still see remnants of the language remnants of their nomenclature in the word Sino, which in certain Latin languages is translated or transliterated Chino, which is their name for Chinese people. And even in modern day, you can see it in the treaties. You have the Sino-Russian Treaty, which is a treaty between Russia and China. They still use the name Sino from Sinite. So Black Africans and Chinese have the same ancestors. They all come from Ham. So you can't use the Bible to justify your racism. Sorry, racist, you can't do that. And where do all these different various physical features come from? They come from isolation. If you isolate people and they only interbreed with each other, then you have a shallow gene pool. They're only going to breed with each other, so they're all going to take on the same physical characteristics. Take people who went into the Norwegian area. They're usually blonde, light-skinned, blue-eyed folk. Why? Because when they went to this area, they were isolated. They didn't intermarry with anyone else. They intermarried with each other. They had a very shallow gene pool. There's very little diversity, so they all start to take on the same physical characteristics. Blonde hair, blue-eyed. Same thing, you go to Ireland. It's an island, very tough to get to. They didn't intermingle with other folks from around the world. They only married each other. They started to look the same because they had a shallow gene pool. There was no diversity, so they all started became red hair and green eyes. And same thing with sub-Saharan Africans. They would, again, isolated, not visited by other folks, no diversity in their gene pool, so they would all start to take on the same physical characteristics, and that's where race comes from. All right, that's all I want to say about that. Racism is stupid, and let's move on. What was the Tower of Babel, and how did it come into being? Well, it all has to do, or it all starts, rather, with an extremely, extremely interesting man, quote-unquote man, you'll see why I put him in quotes in a few minutes, named Nimrod. Nimrod is an extremely important historical figure. In fact, I would argue that he is, aside from biblical characters, I mean the good biblical characters like, Jesus and Joseph and Daniel and all those people. He is probably the most important and impactful human being in history, because he is the originator of a lot of the things that we experience today socially. He is the father of government. He is the father of politics, which gives him a special place in hell, in my opinion, of organized religion. All the things that make up our society and our communities began in Babel, and they began with Nimrod. So let's look at what the Bible says about Nimrod. He starts in the Table of Nations, and he is so important that Moses, when he was penning Genesis, he actually called him out. So let's read here in Genesis chapter 10, beginning in verse 8. And it says, Cush, the son of Ham, begat Nimrod, or had a son named Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one on the earth. That word, that phrase, mighty one, is gibor in Hebrew. The plural is gibberim, very important. We'll talk about that in a second. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. In other words, Nimrod became a legend. He became a saying, like, we talk today about, if you're honest like Abraham Lincoln or George Washington, I cannot tell a lie. He was legendary even in that time. And remember that Moses, when he was writing the law, the first five books of the Bible, he wasn't doing it to educate the Israelites on things they didn't already know. He was just there to differentiate and show God's perspective on this. So when he says this, he knew that the Israelites knew exactly what he was talking about. They knew who Nimrod was. They knew that he was legendary. And so that's why he's only briefly mentioned here by Moses. So he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, hey, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Chaldea in the land of Shinar. And from that land, he went to Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ir, Kala, excuse my pronunciation, and Resen between Nineveh and Kala. That is a principal city. So who is this guy Nimrod? Why is he so important? Well, it says he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. What does that mean? Does that mean he was really good at bagging deer and elk and bringing them before the Lord? No, I think it's a lot more than that. When it says before the Lord, that translation should be in the face of the Lord. And that vernacular means the same as it does in our modern time. When you get in someone's face, you are in a hostile, aggressive, defiant position to them. Nimrod was a mighty hunter in the face of the Lord, or in defiance, in an aggressive posture towards God. He was God's enemy. And I don't believe he was just a hunter of animals. I think in the context, he was a hunter of men. And that since he was basically gathering men together in defiance to God. He wanted men to do the opposite of what God wanted. And what did God want? Well, in Genesis chapter 8, God commands Noah and his descendants to go forth in the earth, multiply, spread out over the earth, and conquer it. Well, we'll find out in a few minutes that Nimrod wanted the opposite. He wanted man to stay all together in one place and not spread around. And I mentioned the Mighty One, or Gibor. Nimrod began to be a Gibor, or a Giborim. Why is that important? Well, because that word, that term, first appears a few chapters over in Genesis chapter 6, which we talked about two podcasts ago. Giborim, or Mighty One, is one of the titles of the Nephilim. Remember, the Nephilim were these hybrids of humans and angelic beings. And they were the reason that the earth had to be flooded, because they were giants. They were physically imposing. They were evil. They were defiant against God. And again, they had a very strong spiritual aspect to them. Nimrod was one of them. Now, it's possible, and some people believe, people who go down this road believe that Nimrod's mother, who is a lady named Semiramis, who we will discuss a lot in the next few podcasts, that she was visited by an angel and was impregnated and begat Nimrod that way. However, I don't think that's what happened, because the Bible says he began to be a Gibor or a Giborim. That means he at one point was not a Giborim and he became one. How? Well, I think it has something to do with, obviously something to do with some angelic, some spiritual things happening. Perhaps he was possessed by an evil demonic entity, or his genes were altered somehow. I don't know how it happened, but it just says right here that he began to be a Giborim. He began to be a Nephilim. Somehow he went from man to these Nephilim hybrids. So he was also probably a giant, and he was very powerful, much more powerful than the other men, which is probably why he became a leader. Also, as a side note, and it's kind of gross actually, Semiramis was not only Nimrod's mother, she was also his wife. So Nimrod basically married his mother, which is pretty disturbing and for many reasons, but that's just another feather in his cap, as it were. It just shows, you know, what a depraved individual he and Semiramis were. And again, we're going to talk about them over the next few podcasts. So among other places and other cities, Nimrod built Babel. Now let's go over to Genesis chapter 11 and just kind of read what happened here. I'm reading from the New King James. Okay, so now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east, we mentioned this before, and they found a plain in the land of Shinar, which is Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq, and they dwelt there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is into the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they have one language. And this is what they began to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad and from there over the face of the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore, its name is called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there, the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth. Babel. What were they doing at Babel? What was going on here? What is this tower they were building? Now, if you just have the biblical orthodoxy, and you just believe the traditional Sunday school lessons, these people were just a bunch of dumb, knuckle-dragging primitives who were so stupid that they thought that God lived in a big magic castle in the clouds, and they were going to build a tower that was so high it would reach into the clouds and they would reach to God. That's not what happened, folks. If you have the supernatural worldview, which we talked about in the last podcast, then you know that there is something very different going on here. What is Babel? Now, granted, Babel or Babel came to mean a scattering of languages, and when someone is said to babble, they're talking in a language in a speech that you don't understand. That's what it came to be, but that is not the original meaning of the word. Babel means gate to God. Bab means gate. El is the singular name of God. You see that name in a lot of places in the Bible. You'll see that surname, like for example, Daniel means God is my judge. Dan means judge. El means God. You'll see Michael, the archangel Michael. Michael means prince. El means God. So Michael means the prince of God. You'll see, you know, Gabriel. You'll see Ezekiel. You'll see the name El in a lot of, you know, in a lot of the names. That's because the word El is the name of God. So Babel means gate to God. So that's what they were building. They were not just building a tower because they thought God lived in the sky. They were building a gateway to God. And if you, again, if you have the supernatural worldview, you recognize what that means. For reasons I don't understand, because I don't know the physics, the spiritual physics of it, there seems to be areas on the earth that serve as some type of nexus point between our physical realm and the spiritual realm. And we see it mentioned throughout the Bible. One of the places we see it mentioned is later on in Genesis, when Jacob, the grandson of Noah, has a vision, or he's given special sight, and he sees a doorway open in heaven, and he sees angels ascending and descending on it. It's called Jacob's Ladder in our vernacular, but it wasn't a ladder, it was a stairway. But there's a door open, and it's a gateway, and angels are coming from the spiritual realm here into the physical realm. And it wasn't a dream, because a little later, Jacob wrestles with one of the angels. So it really happened. So that was a gateway. In Revelation chapter 4, the Apostle John sees a doorway or a gateway opened in heaven, and he is told to come up here. Now, people who believe in the pre-tribulation rapture see that as a euphemism for the rapture, saying come up here into heaven. And I'm not going to get into that here. I talk about the rapture in the blog. You can go over to the right-hand bar and look in that category of your interest, category of the rapture if you're interested, and you can learn about my take on the rapture, pre-trib, mid-trib, and post-trib. But whether or not it has anything to do with the tribulation is irrelevant. The point is, this is another doorway where the physical realm is connected to the spiritual. John goes through that doorway, and he is suddenly in heaven. He's in the throne room of God. You also have the Mountain of Assembly. I talked about this in the series on Eden, that there was the Mountain of God in Eden, the Mount of Assembly, and this was where God and his chief angelic beings came from heaven to earth, and where they conversed and interacted with Adam and Eve. So, and I believe that area is Mount Moriah, and because I talked about why I believe that the Mountain of Assembly is actually in modern day Israel, which is why one of the reasons why that land is so disputed spiritually, because that's where the Mount of Assembly, the Mount of God, is physically located. And I also believe that's where Jesus was crucified. Jesus was crucified on Golgotha at the top of Mount Moriah, so he was technically crucified right at that gateway between the spiritual and the physical realm of God's throne room. And, you know, that's pretty fascinating. We'll talk about that a lot more when we get to the series on Jesus. But, and also in the book of Enoch, and no, Enoch is not canon, but we've talked about this before. However, Enoch is quoted in the Bible directly and referenced in the Bible, so we should take it seriously. And in the book of Enoch, it makes it clear that the angelic incursion that happened in Genesis 6, these angels came down through a gateway on Mount Hermon, which it was also called Bashan. That's where they came through. Here's another fascinating thing I wanted to have in the last podcast. When we have the supernatural worldview and how it changes things, having a supernatural worldview changes what happened, or changes your view of what happened on the Mount of Transfiguration, as well as what happened right before that, when Jesus took the disciples. They climbed up onto a mountain, or they were actually at the foot of a mountain, excuse me. They were at the foot of the mountains of Bashan when Jesus made his famous statement, or at the famous question of, you know, who do men say that I am? And, you know, the disciples say, you know, some say you're Elijah, or, you know, one of the prophets. And then he says, who do you say that I am? And Peter says that, you know, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And then Jesus blesses him and says that, you know, blessed are you, Peter, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I say, thou art Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Well, of course, the Catholics use this as their excuse to try to make Peter into a pope, which is ridiculous for a number of reasons. You can read my series on Catholicism to see that. But Peter was never a pope. He never lived in Rome. He was married. He was not celibate. He never ruled the church. He was never... There's no biblical or logical reason to ever see Peter as a pope. Nevertheless, the name Peter in Greek, Petros, means small stone. So Jesus said, thou art Peter, or Petros, a small stone. But on this rock... And that word Jesus uses in Greek is Petra, which means a mountain or a plateau. I will build my church. So you are Peter. You're a small stone. But on this mountain, I will build my church. Now, most Protestants say that the mountain he's talking about is the mountain of the faith statement that Peter made when he said that, you know, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. But I think denotatively, Jesus is saying that on this rock, on this mountain, I will build my church. What mountain? He was at the foot of the mountain of Bashan, which is Hermon. He was at the gateway that these fallen angels used to have the incursion. He was basically at the gates of hell. So when Jesus said, upon this rock, this mountain, I will build my church, and the gates of hell would not prevail against it, he was standing at the gates of hell. So it gives you a whole new light into what Jesus was saying. Jesus was not, even though we have this unfortunate impression of Jesus as just, as, you know, just this love and peace hippie walking around in a robe with long hair and sandals saying, peace and love, brother. Jesus was bad. Forgive my language, but I can't think of a better way to say it. Jesus was a badass. He went right to where these angels made their incursion, where the demons come from. And he says, on this rock, I'm going to build my church. I'm going to build it right here, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. I'm going to build my rock right where you demons are coming from, and what are you going to do about it? And then a couple of verses, a chapter later, he climbs up to the top of Mount Hermon, Mount Bashan, and that's where he's transfigured. He shows himself in all of his glory. So he goes right up to the gates of hell, to the doorway where the demons come from, where the fallen angels come from, and he reveals himself. He basically says, hey, I'm Jesus, I'm right here. What are you guys going to do about it? He draws a line in the sand, like you remember this when you were in elementary school or grade school or whatever, and when someone was going to fight someone else, they would just get right in their face and say, here I am, what are you going to do about it? That's what Jesus did. Jesus was a badass. He walked right up to where the demons came from and says, here I am, I'm the Son of God. If you guys think you're so bad and you want to, you know, take over and defy my Father's plan, here I am, come at me, bro. And of course, none of them did. So anyway, the point is, these are gateways. These gateways are places on the earth where the spiritual and physical worlds connect, and you can enter one or the other. You can go from the spiritual to the physical world, or from the physical world to the spiritual world. The Tower of Babel, the gate to God, was going to be a portal. They were not building a tall tower because they thought God lived in a cloud in the sky. They were building a doorway, a gateway to God. And it just so happened that all of these gateways typically were on tops of mountains for whatever reason. So they were making their own artificial mountain through this tower, and they were going to, at the top of it, have a gateway. Sounds insane that these folks were going to build a gateway, and you could laugh it off except for one thing. God says very clearly in Genesis chapter 11, verse 6, he says that now that nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. That doesn't mean they were able to do anything. They couldn't flap their arms and fly to Mars. No, he said specifically, nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. What were they proposing to do? They were proposing to build this gateway into heaven. So basically God said that if I don't come down here and confuse their languages, they're going to succeed. God says right there in Genesis chapter 11, verse 6, that if I don't stop them, they are going to succeed in building this gateway. How? Well, I think, again, it has to do with Nimrod, who was, you know, the first world dictator. He was the person who told them to gather together and not be spread around the earth in defiance to what God said. He gathered them together. He was, again, the father of government. He was the first king or dictator, whatever you want to call him. That's what he was. And he is the one who was behind Babel. He was the one behind building this tower. And he obviously had some access to angelic, fallen angelic, quote-unquote, technology and their ways, and he followed their instructions, and he was working with the people to build this gateway. And again, God said they would have succeeded. Why did they want to build a gateway to heaven? Well, people who buy into this philosophy, which I think is true, I think it's, we call it a theory, but I think it's a very true theory, they said that they were actually going to physically invade heaven. I don't think that means that they were necessarily going to think they were going to overthrow God with, you know, spears and bows and arrows and swords, but I think they were trying to get to heaven on their own. Man getting to heaven is the meaning of life. It is God's plan, but God wants to do it by man choosing him, not by choosing his own way. So what the people of Babel were essentially saying is, yeah, God, we're going to go to heaven, but we're not going to take your way. We're going to invade heaven on our own. We don't want to conform to your laws, to your rules, to your rituals, all the things that you want from man. We are of one language. We can do anything we want to do. We are not going to scatter all over the earth. We're going to stay right here. We're going to build a tower, and we are going to fulfill the meaning of life our own way by not waiting for you to do it your way. We're going to build our own gateway, and we're going to go into heaven. What does that mean? That basically means that man chose himself over God in this third dispensation, and that is why that's why the dispensation failed, and God came down and confused their language. Remember, in every dispensation, man has the opportunity to either choose God's way or his own way. In Babel, they chose their own way. They said, we're going to get into heaven, God, but we're going to do it our way, not your way. We choose ourselves and our own capabilities and our own industry and our own God, our own leader, Nimrod, over you. So, as always, the dispensation failed. And God judged them by confusing their languages, and then they scattered throughout the earth based on their own family lines. It says in the previous chapter, in Genesis chapter 10, that they all spoke different languages based on their tribes or their family line. So yes, all the Japhethites spoke a different language than the Hamites, who spoke a different language than the Shemites, and that's how they spread throughout the world, and that's where the Table of Nations comes from, and that's why it is accurate in that sense. So that is an overview of the third dispensation. But there are a lot of things that happen there that we really need to take a deep dive into. And as I said, Babel was the first community. And we all today live in communities. And we live in governments. And we live in principalities and states and nations and, you know, in countries and under various forms of government. So we need to, and importantly, Babel was the beginning of organized religion. That's where we're going to start. We're going to talk about governments a little later in a few podcasts down the road. I think it's a very intriguing and informative discussion that we'll have about where government came from, and not just secular and theocratic governments. But we're going to start with the beginnings of organized religion. In the next podcast, we're going to talk about where organized religion came from and answer a very interesting question, something that was posed to me when I was in college and that I actually hear from a lot of, you know, fairly intelligent people who are skeptics. And they say, if the Bible is true and it's the only way, then why are all the religions of the world so similar? Why are there so many similar stories throughout all the religions of the earth? There are many religions that have stories that sound almost biblical, that have a father, a heavenly father, giving birth to a divine son who dies in a sacrificial way. If you look at the story of Osiris and Isis and Horus, it sounds kind of similar to the biblical story of Jesus and, you know, God and Jesus. And there are a lot of similarities in religions. Why is that? Well, the reason is that all false religions, and every religion that is not Judeo-Christianity is a false religion, all false religions have the same origin. The reason they all sound similar is because they are all corruptions of the true biblical narrative. And we're going to start talking about that in the next podcast. All right, so thank you for listening. I know I went over time again. Sorry, I just have so much to say. I can't combine it all to half an hour all the time. But thanks for hanging in there with me. Please send me your comments. I'd love to hear them. I respond to every single comment, be it on the website or on Facebook, you know, unless it's just something like really ridiculous, or if you're like, you know, just trolling me, I'm not going to respond. I might just erase your message and be done with it. But if you have any intelligent, thoughtful response, I promise I will respond to it and address it. So please give me your comments. I love reading them. Again, thank you for listening. Please subscribe to the blog, subscribe to the podcast, and I will see you next time when we talk about the origin of organized religion.